you decided to chase that rabbit down that rabbit hole, found our link, and pressed play, then yes, you have found your destination. And that destination is the Raw Gypsy Not Quite Hippie Podcast. Hello, everyone. This is Trey Byerjohn, and this is another episode of the Raw Gypsy Not Quite Hippie Podcast. In today's episode, I have the absolute pleasure to interview a raw vegan doctor, a raw vegan, plant-based MD, Dr. Aureli K. Cuevas Ocampo, just happens to be a neuropathologist. She also lives a raw vegan lifestyle. She's been vegetarian most of her life and had switched over to a plant-based vegan diet a few years ago, and just recently switched over to a raw vegan diet. And we get to hear her story today, how she has just propelled herself both physically, mentally, spiritually after changing over to this lifestyle. Dr. Aureli began her life in Mexico, and her mother died at a young age in her mid-30s when Aureli was just a young girl. And I think that may have affected her, you know, her outlook on life and her desire to want to serve others and make sure that maybe that doesn't happen to them. Dr. Aureli spent 6 years in medical school, her final year as a social service servant to the people of Mexico, not being paid and giving care to those who couldn't afford it. She later then moved on to the States, where she was invited and accepted to the University of California of San Francisco. Now, for those who don't know this place, UCSF is also known as the Harvard of the West Coast. This is a very, very prestigious medical school, and she was invited there. So it was it's a big deal for her. So yeah, let's invite Dr. Aureli in, see what makes her tick. Well, hello everyone. This is Trey Byerjohn with the Raw Gypsy Not Quite Hippie Podcast, and today I have the absolute pleasure and honor to have Dr. Aureli Cuevas Ocampo. I hope I said that right. And she is coming from England, I believe. So welcome, Dr. Aureli, to the program.
Thank you, Trey. It's a wonderful opportunity being your podcast. I really appreciate your invitation. Thank you.
You are very welcome, and the honor is all mine, dear. Before we get started, I don't know if you're familiar with our podcast, but we do a little thing called the hot seat, and that's where I ask each guest four random questions. Has nothing to do with the podcast necessarily, just some fun icebreaker questions.
All right, sounds great.
Okay, great. Okay, so question number one. If happiness was the world's currency, what would you do? What would be your job that would make you rich?
Wow. Okay, so I just want to make sure that I understood the question. So everything that we use as coins and bills are like coins or bills of happiness?
Yes. So if the world's currency, if you got paid,
yes,
and your payment was just pure happiness, what would your job be that would make you just rich, abundant?
Oh my God. Okay. So oddly enough, I like to see people happy. Some people are like, no, I just want happiness for myself, but I actually like a happy environment. So for me, if everyone is happy, everything works perfectly. So that would be one of the things, making sure that everyone around me is happy. I mean, that would be my first answer. Then maybe being surrounded by nature, that really makes me happy. And the other is music. I love music, that makes me happy. And raw foods, for sure. Yes.
That's beautiful. And it, I wish it was that simple. I do. I really wish it was.
Yeah.
That would be too. Awesome. Great. Number two, if you could choose one fruit or vegetable that you haven't tasted yet, but you are just cannot wait to taste, what would that one vegetable or fruit be?
Vegetable or fruit, mm-hmm. Right?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I've only had durian frozen. Mm. So I would like to taste the ripe, fresh one directly from the tree.
Yeah, that sounds, I haven't tasted durian. I've heard mixed, not mixed reviews, but just differing taste examples of what it tastes like. So I'm curious myself. I would love to see what it tastes like myself.
Right.
Number three, what is one thing that you're holding on to that you really need to let go of? And it could be physical, emotional, spiritual.
The thing that I'm holding on to?
Mm-hmm. Something that you're just holding on to tight and you really need to let go of. And it could be, like I said, something physically, something emotionally, spiritually.
Self-doubt, you know, that has holding me all my life. And now that I have a reason and a mission and a passion to live life to the fullest, I really need to let it go.
Yeah, that makes sense. It does make sense. I think mine is fear or worry. Mine is worry. I've heard a saying that says, worry is a 100% payment on a debt that you may never owe. And regardless of whether I know that or not, I still worry. And I wish that is one thing that I wish I could let go of too. I really do. All right, number four is a would you rather question. So would you rather be a world-class artist or a world-class singer?
Wow. I think artist, because I like music, so I don't necessarily need to sing to make art. So I would rather be a composer.
Ooh.
Yes.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
I love art. I love art as well. I do. I really do. Well, wonderful. Wonderful. That's it. That's the hot seat. And you did very well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, Dr. Aureli, where are you located right now?
Right now, I live in a city, which is located in the southwest of England. It's called Bristol. So this is where I work as a consultant.
Oh, wow. Beautiful. What's the weather like there?
Well, you know, people have this misconception about England and the weather. It's not that bad. I think it resembles the Seattle weather, maybe less rainy. And in terms of the winter, it's not as cold as in New York or Boston or the East Coast, Northeast Coast. It's basically like four seasons. It rains more than usual, but nothing unbearable. And it's similar to North Carolina, I think.
What's the temperature? Yeah. What's the temperature like there today?
Today, so I'm getting used to the degrees, Celsius degrees. So it will be, the highest was close to 20. So it will be maybe 60, right?
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow. That's nice.
It's nice.
It's very nice. It's
rainy a little bit, but then it went away. So.
Well, good. Well, good. Good. Awesome. So what brought you there? What brought you to Bristol? You said you're doing consulting work there?
Yeah, so I'm a medically trained doctor, and I did pathology, which is, you know, lab medicine behind the scene. We analyze tissues and biopsies and autopsies and fluid. So I did that as a training in Mexico once I graduated from medical school. But then I decided to, you know, explore the world. And I said, yeah, I want to practice in the U.S. So in order to do that, I went to the U.S. and studied in Massachusetts for 4 years in pathology. And then I decided to further specialize in the brain, which is neuropathology. And when I was looking for jobs in the US, because I'm not a US citizen, I had to apply to areas that are not very popular, because in order to get residency in the US, I have to serve the country. So the penalty, let's put it that way, is to serve for 3 years in an underserved area. And I got job offers where in cities that were not my, you know, my forte, my cup of tea. And then I also applied in Canada and in the UK, and the work, the job that I got here, I think was the best option. So that's why I'm here. So I move across the ocean.
Wow.
I know.
That's awesome. Well, that's, we'll back up and delve off into your early years, if you don't mind. So So you were born in Mexico. What part of Mexico were you born?
It's a small city that is 1 hour south driving from Mexico City. It's called Cuernavaca, which is the city of the forever spring or something like that. Like, yeah, that's what it's famous for. But so I grew up there and I went to medical school at the State University. And then I went to Mexico City to pursue my training in pathology.
Okay. And then if I remember right, I heard your story where you had went to school for 6 years. It's a 6-year program there, correct?
Yeah. And the Mexican medical system, every single medical school has a 6-year program.
Right.
So
right.
4 years of classroom. Well, basically it's 2 years of classroom, which is basic sciences like anatomy, physiology, pathology, biology, then 2 years of clinical sciences, which is in the hospital. You do rotations. So you go to the rheumatology clinic, gynecology clinic, pediatrics. And then your fifth year is the internship, which is 1 year you live in the hospital. It's mandatory for everyone, not just the ones that are going to be hospitalists, but everyone. So right. You spend there 1 year. And then the last year is social service, where you are actually the doctor, but you go to a rural area, a community to serve the people, because medical education, fortunately, is free, pseudo free in my country. So that's why we have 6 years.
You know, I found that part of your story fascinating. The fact that, residency, the fifth year of residency, that's not uncommon, up here in the States. But that sixth and final year of social, outreach that you were doing, that just, I find that fascinating, and I applaud it. For one, I know, well, I don't know. I can assume that it seemed it is like you were maybe beating your head against the wall, or just trying to struggle to get these people taken care of. But the ability to be able to reach folks who need it, I just find fascinating. Could you talk a little bit more about that last year? What was that like?
Yeah, it's curious that you ask that, because it has to do a lot with why I'm here today. I remember, just to give you a little bit of context, I was in my internship fifth year, and I really like surgery, like the action, like, oh yeah, I'm gonna save lives, and when I have my hands on and the action and all that. So somebody told me, think about it. It's exciting, it's glamorous as they portray it in the TV, but it's not actually like that. Look around and see how many surgeons are actually happy. So I was, okay, I still have 1 year to think about it. So I went to the social service and I really enjoyed the close contact with the community. But strangely enough, I realized also that people don't take care of themselves. And no matter how the doctor tells them something, right, they're not compliant to the treatment unless they want. So for me, it was kind of shocking, but it was also an opportunity to realize that this is not what I want to do for life. Because back in the day, I didn't know anything about raw food and plant-based prevention and all that. It was more, okay, you are diabetic, I'll give you the standard treatment. You are hypertensive, I give you anti-hypertensive drugs. So it's normal. People don't adapt to something that is not working for them. I mean, yeah, if they're complying with the medications, their blood sugar is going to go down or their blood pressure is going to go down, but it's not something that they enjoy because the root of the problem is not addressed. So I just realized, this is not for me. People are not compliant. They blame the doctor when they feel sick and they fail, but then they attribute their success to healing their diseases to the witchcraft or something like that, right? So I was like, yeah, I like people, but they're not very nice patients. So I realized, how can I help people, but at the same time, not compromising my happiness? And I didn't want to be prescribing drugs all the time, because I realized early on that that was not the solution. So I said, okay, I'm kind of a nerd. I like to read a lot. I like to understand diseases. I want to make diagnosis rather and forget about treating patients. So that's why I chose pathology. But that was basically the experience, the social service, that made me realize that probably being a little bit distant was better for me.
Maybe a little bit of a hands-off approach as opposed to a hands-on.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Did it Did you find that your schooling, and it's not necessarily because of where you were going to school, because it's lacking in the States as well, but the nutrition, or the lack thereof, nutritional studies is pretty prevalent. You know, there's not a lot of nutritional studies in early medical, in the medical field. So I was curious, did you find that a struggle to go out there to try to help these folks and really not know what to do? But at the same time, I know you said you were having a hard time with them because they were kind of grumpy, I guess, for being, because they're, you know, let's face it, they're not feeling well. But was how was your schooling as far as nutritional goes in the early years?
Yeah, I just want to clarify because probably I didn't come across that the way I like it. No, they were not grumpy. It was like they were not compliant with the treatment, and they were basically just kind of like, yeah, I will follow your instructions, but nothing happened ever. So it was more like, okay, they're nice people, but they're not willing to put the effort. So just to clarify that, they were nice people. Wow. So in terms of nutrition, the allopathic medical school philosophy focuses on disease treatment rather than disease prevention. So this nutrition and plant-based introduction into the medical schools is just happening, and it's not even official worldwide. Don't let me start with Mexican health systems, because unfortunately, every single progress that happens nowadays happens first in the US, just because the problem is more prominent over there. But the plant-based doctor movements is strongest in the US as in any other part of the world. So it's not the exception that the Mexican medical school system, back in my days when I studied medical school, was very poor in nutrition. I always say, when they ask me, how many hours of nutrition you had during your 6 years of career? Well, I had a 3-month course of nutrition of 1 hour every week per 3 months. So that will make it less, around 20 hours of nutrition during 6 years. So that's nothing. And basically my nutrition courses were like, okay, what are proteins? What are carbohydrates, macronutrients, fatty acids, metabolism of lipids, like mostly related to treatment, right? Like, okay, if a patient has hypercholesterolemia, statins, how this, you know, all the liver metabolism. So yeah, it wasn't very, I don't even remember what I learned in nutrition classes. So yeah, that's part of the challenge.
Right. I think I messaged you and told you that I was diagnosed with familial hypercholesterolemia at 6, and I had atherosclerosis at 6. And my liver and spleen was severely enlarged. They thought I may have had liver cancer. They really didn't know what was going on. They had not seen something that drastic in a 6-year-old kid, you know, that early. And that was in 1978. I was 6. I'm 47. So it was 1978. And their answer then was to put me on a low-fat diet, not to put me on a plant-based diet, not to put me, you know, they didn't want to put me on statins, I don't think, right away, just because of how young I was and my liver was so, you know, compromised at the time. But they just put me on a low-fat diet, and it took about 4 years for my cholesterol to get under control.
Wow.
You know, so, you know, the U.S. medical, the dietary education in the U.S. is not as good either. I went through some medical training too, and mostly we focused on palliative care, you know, as far as nutrition goes. So it was very lacking.
Yeah. And let me tell you something, when, in order to train in the US for pathology and neuropathology, I have to retake the tests that all the American medical graduates take in order to become doctors. So I did basically many tests in my life. So I know what is the curriculum of the U.S. medical system because I have studied for those tests. So it's similar, very similar.
Wow, that's impressive. You had to go through it there, and then you had to come here and do it here. And
I know.
You are well-trained, my dear, well-trained.
Very well-trained.
So you graduated. You went through your sixth year, social services, treating those folks. And then go from there. What happened after that?
So by that time, when I was telling you that in my internship, I realized that surgery was my passion kind of thing. And then, you know, realizing in my social studies that no, maybe now I don't want to see patients. I decided, okay, I don't like the whole medical system. I always kind of thought that the textbooks where I learned medicine from are coming from authors that live in the US. So I thought, well, why I don't reach out to and be trained by the best of the best. So I just, it just came to my mind, like, I'm gonna move to the US and I'm gonna practice there. So during my social service, I kind of planned out what to do in order to accomplish that. So I said, okay, I'm a medical graduate from abroad. They're not gonna open the doors easily. So I have to bring something to the table. So I said, well, if I don't do it in the US, well, I'm gonna go into residency in my country. So I entered into pathology residency. By the way, I repeated pathology. So in pathology as a resident, I earned money for the first time. And I was saving and at the same time studying for all these exams in order to pass the US tests. So I did that for 3 years. I graduated from pathology in Mexico and applied for residency in the US at the end of my career or my training here as a pathologist. So I was invited for several interviews in the US because obviously they like my scores, they like my background, my training in pathology back home. So I ended up in Massachusetts. I was offered a pre-match, which is something that happens to kind of a little bit more advanced candidates, not because I was like the great thing, or it was just because of my training and my credentials, of course. So got a pre-match, and then I studied pathology in Massachusetts. I repeated it, but at the same time, I gained more knowledge because there are more subjects and more things to learn. So after pathology, I was thinking, what should I do? I mean, being a general pathologist is great, but I need more training. And I'm really fascinated by the brain, not only from the anatomical point of view, but also from the psychological point of view, like all this, what makes us human, and, you know, emotions and intention and the power of the mind, etc. So I said, well, the closest thing that I can do in order to understand more this organ is doing a neuropathology fellowship, which I did. And then in neuropathology, I moved to San Francisco at UCSF. That's what I trained. And and after that, I started looking for jobs, and that's why I'm here now.
Congratulations on that, by the way. That's a pretty big step right there to University of California of was it University of California San Francisco?
Yeah.
UCSF. They're quite acclaimed.
It's a very top notch place. Yes.
Yes, that's putting it very humbly. You know, you're being very humble by saying that because they're a big deal. They're a big deal. So I congratulate you on that.
Thank you.
Neuropathology is. Any kind of pathology I find fascinating. The study of diseases, it just in any part of the body is fascinating. It's fascinating. And to do it in the brain, I'm a heart guy. I like the heart. That's my favorite organ. It's the one I'm more familiar with, I guess, that and the arteries, the arterial part of it. But the brain is super fascinating. And the fact that you were able to get to UCSF and neuropathology is awesome, absolutely awesome. So
thank you.
Congratulations.
Yeah, all my professors over there, I mean, I have huge respect for my colleagues or ex-colleagues and ex-mentors. I learn a lot from them. And I mean, don't take me wrong, what they're doing is great. They're, you know, helping people with their knowledge. And everybody in the medical system goes to medicine for the same reason. I don't know about you, but I'm sure that anyone who you know goes to medicine for the right reasons, they want to help people. Some of them want to get rich, right? But most of us come because, yeah, that's my calling, right? So,
yeah.
Yes.
No doubt. You know, your story of when you were younger, your mother had passed away from breast cancer.
Yes.
How old were you when she passed away? Or how old were you when she was diagnosed, and then how long before she
died? Well, I didn't know. When she was diagnosed, probably I was close to being 5 years old, but I didn't know what was going on. I only knew that my mom was sick. And I vaguely remember, you know, seeing her on bed and all these treatments and how she vomited, I guess, for the chemotherapy. And she passed away when I was 6 years old. Oh, wow. So I remember a year of struggle for my whole family. So, yeah, it was, you know, maybe that was the reason why I'm a doctor, maybe subconsciously trying to help. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, you're given gifts, I believe, and obviously that was one of your gifts, and it may have been the catalyst or the thing that pushed you forward. But I have a feeling that that was probably always in your DNA to be a doctor or to be a servant, which yeah. I find beautiful. How old was she when she passed away?
Yeah, that's a great question because. I'm currently the age that my mom reached when she passed away, so 35.
Oh,
yeah. So that's young.
That's young, dear. That is too young.
Yeah, I mean it's unimaginable to think that a 34, 33 year old woman got cancer, but yeah, it happened. And
yeah. Well, my heart goes out to you, dear. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. So you finished, or you were working at the, let's fast forward a little bit. So you were working at University of California, San Francisco. And so you were actually working there, correct?
Yeah, I was a fellow. So fellowship means that you are an employee, but at the same time, you're a trainee. So you're not literally responsible for all the diagnosis, but you do all the work, but the ones who sign up and you learn from your mentors, of course they do work, but that's basically it. You get paid, so I was able to, since I was a resident in the US, to afford my rent, my car, my bills, everything, but at the same time learning.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's good stuff. So what kind of stuff did you see? What was tell me about some of the most interesting cases that you that come across your desk.
So neuropathology, as a pathologist or neuropathologist?
Yes, as a neuropathologist or as a pathologist, which I'm
well,
sure.
Yeah, I guess the most fascinating things is like seeing all these, not fascinating because I enjoy it, but it's just like impressive how disease can spread in your body. These debulking surgeries where poor women, you know, they have cervical cancer or endometrial cancer, and this cancer spreads all over the abdominal cavity. So they have to do a debulking surgery where they take not only the uterus, but also the fallopian tubes, the ovaries, sometimes part of the intestine, sometimes the bladders, like depending on how extensive the cancer is. So that's very impressive and shocking. Other things, obviously, my favorite is to do the brain cut. Every person that dies and that they donate their organs for research or to investigate the cause of death, and we get the opportunity to see the brains, it's just wonderful to hold the brain in my hands and to cut it up, you know, cut it and see the slices and take the sections. So that's fascinating for me. That's why I'm doing what I do right now.
Right.
Yeah. All the things that I've seen, and it's, again, shocking, amputations. Like legs of people with vascular disease, peripheral vascular disease, mm-hmm. where their arteries are so clogged, that are so hard because they're calcified. That's atherosclerosis.
Right.
Arteriosclerosis, sorry. What else? Seeing the heart and finding the cause of death, like myocardial infarction, and correlating that with the textbook and see how it matches all the physiology and all the mechanisms, like, okay, at 72 hours you see this discoloration, at 24 hours you see this pathology, at 72 hours you see the neutrophils, and you know, all these descriptions matching that up, that's great. I mean, not for the disease, but from the medical point of view, is fascinating to be a witness of all these things.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. I always found it fascinating the way that I was a certified EKG tech, and to look at an EKG and to be able to see the wave whenever there's necrotic tissue after a heart attack, a person who's had a heart attack, there's a void because the electrical activity that's running through that area, there's a void. So it shows up on the EKG and you can see, you know, you can tell, I could look at a, at an EKG and I could tell somebody, especially if it's a 12 lead EKG, I could look at it and tell them, okay, well, you had a heart attack and it was on this side of the body, whether it was, or this side of the heart, whether it was anterior or posterior, you know, whatever, ascending, descending. And you could tell just by that EKG and that necrotic tissue. I just thought, I thought that was fascinating, the way all that works. And it's the human body is so resilient.
Yeah.
You know, all it wants to do is live, you know, and I just find it fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So I imagine you did too. That's, you know, that's what keeps you going, keeps you in the field. It fascinates you. And like you said, it's not in a good way. It's not a good fascination. It's just almost an awe, maybe.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's good stuff. So when, so you were at UCSF, what happened? You're not there anymore. Of course, you're now in England. What was the next step?
To move to England.
To move to England. Okay.
Yeah. So I had to, it's amazing. Like now you're making me think, I'm certified to practice medicine in Mexico, in the US, and now in England. So unfortunately, I cannot practice nutrition at the level that I want because I need like another paper that says that I'm, you know, I can, I'm competent to do that, but that's another story. So in order to move to the UK, I had to validate my credentials. Mm-hmm. And that took me almost a year gathering all the evidence because this, the UK system is a little bit bureaucratic, so a little bit or a lot bureaucratic. So I had to compile over 7,000 sheets of evidence, just going back to my logbooks, and it was, I don't even remember how I made it, but I had to do it in order to be registered on the General Medical Council, General Medical Council. So yeah, that's what happened. I got a job offer here. So once I got the job offer, I spent almost a year compiling that evidence, and they were nice enough to wait for me because I was a candidate, I guess, that they wanted. So I got the certification or the registration here, and that allowed me to move, and I got a job and the visa and all the paperwork that, yeah, is the difficult part rather than being a doctor, the bureaucracy involved.
Wow. Did, yeah. Were you studying neuropathology then, or were you still in general pathology?
Oh, no, I was at UCSF in neuropathology, mm-hmm. and it was in the second year where it's a little bit milder than the first year, so I was able to do that.
Good deal.
Yeah.
So what was, so at this time you had not changed your diet at all? You were still eating, I guess, for the lack of better words, a standard American diet, which is our SAD diet?
No. So when I was in the social service, when I was serving the community in Mexico, I was overweight. Actually, I was overweight at the end of my internship because you can imagine non-sleeping for 36 to 48 hours straight, all these cortisol spikes definitely make me gain some pounds. So I asked a colleague, like, okay, I want to lose weight. What can I do? At the end of my internship, I did the Atkins diet for a year. And I lost weight for sure, but I was not energetic. My skin was terrible, still a lot of acne because obviously I hadn't eliminated the animal products and all these inflammatory fats from animals. So I just, you know, on my own terms and in my own time, I was like, this is not sustainable. I'm not enjoying this. I mean, no fruit, nothing, just protein. So I came across vegetarianism and that made sense to me. So from 2009 to 2013, I was vegetarian, but I was still overweight a little bit with some acne because of the cheese. I was addicted to dairy. And then in 2013, I knew about raw veganism because I was watching Dan McDonald videos. I don't know if you know that guy.
Who was it again?
Dan McDonald, the live regenerator.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yes, I love him, yes.
So I always find him so inspiring. Rather than his juices and his van, it was more his speech, like all the light. And I was like, yeah, fascinated with the guy, but never implemented that on myself. But I knew about raw veganism since I went vegetarian, because when I went vegetarian, I kind of suck all the information that I could handle, right? At the time, not understanding what I was doing, but it was in 2013, after 6 years of being vegetarian, that I watched Earthlings, and that made me go vegan overnight. It was November 30, 2013, and I was disgusted and shocked by the, you know, meat and dairy industry, and I went vegan. And then from 2013 to 2016, I was vegan, like, you know, healthy, but still junk vegan food, bread and frappuccinos and donuts and things like that. But 2016, I said, you know what, I'm going to go more healthy. And I tried the raw until 4 version. Mm-hmm. And I did that for a couple of years with good results, but not necessarily felt at my best. And I said, you know what, I feel better when I'm raw. And I was experimenting with that. So I was high raw before 2018, but it was January 1st, like New Year's resolution, to be fully raw. And I've been since then, January 1st, 2018.
Wow. That's,
so, yeah, I was still at UCSF.
That's good stuff. It's a progressive. It's amazing. You went a little cleaner, a little cleaner, a little cleaner. And then, and you know, you may still have a little ways to go, you know, to get as clean as you want to be, but you know, you're on the right track, obviously. I mean, I've seen your befores and afters, and I followed you, and I saw your befores and afters and read your story and heard your story. And yeah, it's impressive. It's very impressive. And it's so true what you said, that because you were going through your fifth year and your residency and whatnot, I've said this before, that people who are the most selfless, meaning that they don't think of themselves as much as they think of others, seem to put themselves at harm, you know, with their bodies, whether it be nurses, especially nurses and doctors too. They, you know, they just don't have a lot of time for themselves because they're spending so much time taking care of everybody else. And moms have that tendency to do the same thing. They're taking care of the little ones and they just don't take care of themselves. So I can understand that you've got a little out of hand there. And, you know, I tried the Atkins diet myself too, and it was devastating. It was not good. But the fact that you were able to go vegetarian and then, you know, watch Earthlings, oh my gosh, that show will change your life. So, that's fascinating. You went through your little progression, and so now you're here. Now you're raw vegan.
I am raw vegan, and it's awesome. Just started.
And glowing, and just glowing. Look at you.
Oh, thank you.
Just glowing. So when you were at UCSF, you were raw vegan by then, or no?
Yeah. So it was the last year of my training. So I graduated in July, 30 of June. 2018. So I was raw for 6 months, and it wasn't like, so with all this transition, like trying to gather the evidence for the UK bureaucracy, trying to, you know, work on my project in my second year of fellowship and trying to be raw vegan, it was challenging, but you know, I was determined. So 6 months into raw veganism, still at UCSF, when I moved to England, it was still, you know, another transitional period, because, okay, how can I make this work? But now I'm solid for sure.
Raw veganism was, I'm just assuming, and I, forgive me if I'm wrong, but in San Francisco, the vegan movement, raw and even maybe raw, would probably be, I would feel like it would be more welcoming or easier. Did you find that to be the case?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, California is paradise. California has all the fruits and vegetables that you can imagine. And you have a lot of organic produce and seasonal products. And it's not that difficult in England. And I found that, you know, at the beginning I was scared, like, oh my God, I'm going to move to a country where it's just rainy. And, you know, I thought the worst. But no, actually, I have the opportunity to get very good produce, because it's imported, and it's coming from Spain, which is just next door. Oh, obviously, wow. You have to fly, but
sure.
Products from Spain, from Morocco, from Iran, from Brazil, from all these places and all these fruits and vegetables that I didn't have the experience to buy back in America.
Yeah, so, that was going to be my next question was, you know, did you find it difficult change to go to England? But it doesn't sound like you did.
Well, in terms of gourmet raw food, yes, it's more difficult here because over there you have Whole Foods. You just go to the salad bar and you just have your raw food salad and you can have a raw vegan dessert with these go raw bars and all these things, right? But here the raw vegan movement is not that strong yet. And even the organic is not as strong. You only have the Planet Organic, which are stores similar to Whole Foods, but are only in London. So yeah, the challenge for me was there at the beginning because of the gourmet raw versions, but I think it's actually an advantage because now I eat more clean and I'm satisfied with that.
Right. It probably tests your creativity as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Did you notice that any differences in the way that you felt, like your clarity, train of thought, things like that, when you were back in San Francisco, when you switched over to a, you know, completely raw diet? Did you notice anything physically?
Well, physically, I was able to downsize myself a little bit more. I was able to keep my skin clean. Those are the most noticeable physical, you know, changes. But in terms of digestion, in terms of mental clarity, it was a little bit of a struggle, but I don't think it was the raw diet. It was the whole stress that I was undergoing at the time. But I guess what really rescued me was keeping myself raw and not gaining weight in the process, because in the past I always had these yo-yo patterns, even when I was vegetarian or high raw. It's like, okay, stressful situation, overeat, binge eating. Right. But now with raw, it was like, even though I was sometimes binge eating on raw, my weight and my skin was clear. So that was a big gain. What else happened? I did another juice fast even when I was raw because I thought, okay, I need to, you know, maybe cleanse a little bit more. So I did a month in October, September 2018 of juicing. Just using 4 gallons, not 4 gallons, 4 liters, 1 gallon or more. So that's what, I think that really served me a lot to reset my body and say, okay, you know, you just have to calibrate, readjust and keep going. So yes. Yeah,
that is, that's very important. How long were you on the juice fast?
Like a month.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Good one. It'll teach you a lot, won't it?
Yeah.
It'll teach you that you're not necessarily hungry. You just crave a lot. Yeah. Aren't good for you.
It was the most amazing time in my life. That's when the mental clarity was to the roof. That's actually the month where I decided to go on social media. That was the month when I accepted a YouTube interview. That was the month where many things happened in my life. So I'm so grateful that I did it.
Yeah, that mental clarity came around and you just got out of your own way and it all kind of became clear. Yeah. That's what it sounds like anyway. You know, you mentioned earlier about inflammation. I've heard you talk about inflammation before and I was talking with my wife last night. We were talking about inflammation and you know, foods that cause inflammation and things like that. And I think you had mentioned before that most diseases are caused from inflammation. And you either see cancer or inflammation in some of your pathology reports that you're looking at. And I found it fascinating that people tend to maybe not delegitimize, but they don't take it as seriously maybe as it should. And I'll give you, for instance, if you go to the doctor and they tell you that you have sinusitis, and then at first you think, oh my God, I have sinusitis, you know, and then you look it up and it's basically inflammation of the sinuses. And which itis, you know, means inflammation. And they seem to not take it as serious. It's just a sinus infection basically, or dermatitis or any of the inflammations. We tend to, at least over here, we tend to not take it as seriously. And that seems to me as a sign that the body's telling you, it's almost like a check engine light, you know, hey, there's something going on. Let's get this checked out. Let's figure it out. But yeah. we don't seem to address that. Do you seem to see these in some of your pathology reports? Do you see causes of inflammation that could cause some of these problems, you know, in some of your reports in the brain? Yeah.
Well, at the moment I deal with two type of things, mostly. One is cancer, unfortunately. The other is inflammation, and a third one, it will be neurodegeneration. So I will dare to say that most of these conditions have a root in an inflammatory process, an aggression to the body that, as you mentioned before, the body is so resilient, but there is always a limit, and different genetic susceptibilities that you may have may be the reason why you get certain type of disease versus me, that I get other type of diseases. Yeah. So in the brain, as I was telling you, cancer is what I do mostly for. I mean, I do cancer diagnosis every day mostly. I don't want to say it's the food all the time that causes cancer. Like some people live in houses where electricity towers are there, right? And this has been an association with cancer and living under towers, power towers. But it's inflammation at the end, right? So if we want to talk about electromagnetic frequencies, we don't know, but for sure it's causing inflammation. Inflammation is just a response to the body to an aggressor. It's right. A defense mechanism. But when it goes without control, that's when bad things happen. So in order to repair, the body needs to produce more cells to kind of put some cement and bricks to seal the damage. Right. So that happens without control. You just throw bricks and more bricks and more bricks. Those are cancer cells, and cancer happens. So yeah, I think inflammation is the root cause of most of our problems.
Yeah, I agree. I do agree with you. You know, I think many cancers are caused by our environment. And like you said, it may not be food. It could be black mold. It could be electrical issues. It could be asbestos, you know, mesothelioma is, you know, that's definitely not a foodborne cancer. But I think, you know, we tend to surround ourselves with environmental causes that help bring it to that point. And very seldom is it a genetic disorder that, you know, that causes it. It's usually our food or our surroundings, environment, smoking, chewing tobacco, things like that. Inflammation is the key. You're right. It's like I said, it's almost like a check engine light for your body telling you, hey, there's something going on. We need to get this fixed. And we tend to ignore it and not pay it as close attention as we should. And we also seem to not be preemptive or preemptive and try to take preemptive action and, you know, eating healthy, trying to drink, you know, cleaner water and just things like that. I think if we did that, a lot of this may go away or at least reduce it quite a bit. So your endeavors to that into that field of health on a naturopathic way, I believe is an admirable thing to do, and it's probably a very wise thing to do, and you're probably able to reach a whole lot more people than looking at cancer cells in the brain.
Yeah, I mean it will be great if we can prevent these diseases, because they are so debilitating, and the mortality is huge. If you have skin cancer, for example, and if they resect the mole or the cancer is in your skin, you have high survival rates, unless it's melanoma, but the rest of like basal cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, it's so easy to heal, right? If you resect it completely. But something in the brain, even if it's a benign tumor, is devastating just because of the location. I mean, to access the brain, you have to drill, you know, the cranium. And besides cancer, neurodegeneration and dementia, I think is the saddest way to die, to be honest with you. My grandmother passed away because of Alzheimer's. And it was so sad seeing herself being lost, like not knowing who she was. And, you know, I don't know what is worse, if cancer or dementia, but yeah.
Do you think that dementia could be assisted with a whole food? And I'm not asking you to diagnose or to say anything that's out of your above your pay grade. But do you feel that food, diet could help with folks with dementia?
Yeah, it's just the lifestyle factors that we were talking about. It's not only food, but the environment. So how do you create a healthy environment for yourself? Well, you surround yourself with positive people, healthy relationships. You create a good environment around you. You go out for exercising in nature and breathing fresh air. You challenge your mind, and you are not just consuming, you know, in your phone the information that it's giving to you. You're actually doing some, you know, mental work and things like that. So for me, saying that dementia can be prevented just on a raw vegan diet will be very bold to say, because dementia has multiple reasons, but most of them are acquired, like the dementia that we know, Alzheimer's. There are many types of dementia, but the ones that we see, it's going to be bold to say this, but I'm totally sure that are preventable. So it's just lifestyle modifications. For sure, there's hereditary Alzheimer's disease, just as your hypercholesterolemia, right? It's not because of your bad diet. It's just because you have a genetic mutation in your liver, right, or blood. So same with dementia. The majority of dementia is acquired rather than genetic. So it's a lifestyle approach rather than just diet. But amongst the best diets, I think the raw vegan diet is the cleanest and the most anti-inflammatory. So for sure, it's going to help.
Yeah. If not cure, at least, like you said, at least it'll help. You'll be the healthiest you that you can be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have any rebuttals or naysayers in the family, in your family, your friends, even maybe your colleagues and peers when you were outed as a raw vegan?
For sure. I'm sure I am. But at this moment in my life, I'm so sure about what I am. And, you know, I reached the maturity level to kind of, you know, dust it off, because I know what I'm standing for. I don't think they are necessarily bad, or they don't have like an intrinsic bad, I don't know, like bad intentions, right? If they judge me, it's just because they don't understand. And whatever we don't understand, like you were mentioning, fear, we are afraid of the unknown. We are afraid of what is outside of the norm. Right. So my colleagues, my friends, my family members that see myself, because I'm very vocal and I'm very visible now. I'm like not ashamed at all. I'm actually very proud, but they don't see it. So it's unknown, it's new for them. So the only defense mechanism that they have, because they are reminded with my actions that probably they should do better in terms of taking care of themselves, is either criticism or judgment. But it's not coming from a bad place. I think it's just human nature. So
do you have anybody, friends, family, peers that changed their lifestyle or maybe their diet because of it?
I'm so proud of my aunt. She saw my transformation and she's like, I've been dealing with weight problems all my life and I have to do what you're doing. So she's been raw vegan since maybe almost a year ago. And she has dramatically improved her appearance, her health, her vitality. So that's the only one in my family that actually followed my advice. The rest of my family, they're just kind of like reluctant still to do that, even going vegan. My little sister, my dad married again, so I have a half sister. She wants to go vegan. She understands the dimension, the importance of this diet, not only for her health, but for the planet, for the animals. So she's very compassionate and sensitive to these issues, but my dad's still reluctant, you know, and I'm not afraid of saying this here because I don't speak English, so they don't know that I'm Yeah.
Well, that's okay. That's okay too. And how old is your aunt?
My aunt is around maybe in her 40s.
Okay. So she's 50. That's yeah. good. That's good though. You know, and I started when I was 40. I'm 47 now, so I started when I was 44.
Wow. You look super young.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I started at 44 and, you know, I feel like 50 is my halfway point. I haven't reached my halfway point yet. So, tell your aunt that thankfully, hopefully, that she hasn't reached her halfway point either. She's just getting there. So, and I think that would go a long way. And all you can do is be you, be vibrant, be glowing. That big smile on your face that you always have, which is absolutely stunning, and just be you, and hopefully that would exude enough, goodwill and good intentions and good. Obviously, you're doing well, so hopefully they'll see that and say, oh, you know what, Aurelie's got some, she's got some a point of view that I might want to follow. So maybe they'll come along. Maybe they'll come along.
I'm optimistic. Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. Do what's a day in the life like for you? What do you do in a general day, and what do you eat?
Okay, so I am trying to wake up at 5, but it's not always possible. I put the alarm at 5, but sometimes I hit the snooze button, so I may wake up around 5:30. So I get ready and I go for a run in the morning. Just to put my mindset in the right place and to breathe fresh air, basically. And that's my power hour. That's what Tony Robbins says. So that's what I do. Then I cycle to work. That takes me 20 to 25 minutes up the hill. I shower when I arrive to work. And I am ready to start working around 8:30. So work is from 8:30 to 5, more or less, sometimes 6, depending on the amount of job that I have. And then during my work, on my way to work, I stop by at the grocery store, which is like a local family-owned business.
Right.
So they bring all these fruits from all these wonderful countries. So on my way cycling up to work, I fill my backpack with all the food that I'm going to eat during the day. So whatever it is, like a lot of peaches, a lot of mangoes, watermelon or bananas, leafy greens. And yeah, that's what I have in my office during the day. So I start eating around 10, 11, and I stop eating around 4. I mean, I do basically two main meals between 11 and 4.
Right.
And once I finish work, I cycle back to home. And I prepare myself a big salad, a big dinner, and then the rest of the afternoon is either catching up with work, which is rare because I don't have my microscope, but at least reading. And I do my social media work, which is my side project, because awesome. I believe that being a neuropathologist doesn't stop me from being a doctor, and my intentions for being a doctor is helping people. So once I find out that diet plays an important role in health, this is what I want to do.
Right. So you don't eat. Your first meal is at 10. That's when you break your fast. Is it 10 o'clock?
10, 11. Yeah. 10 or 11? I don't eat anything until, yeah. So I usually do every day 16 hour fast.
Hmm. You drink water. Do you drink water when you first
get up? Yes, I drink water. Yeah.
Yeah. Drink water when you first get up, and then you get to work and you drink, you start eating around 11. And then what time is your last meal?
It depends. If it's a busy day at work, maybe, I don't know, it's just very intuitive. So it could be around 2 p.m., could be around 3:30 sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
But then you said you make your salad when you get home at night, when you get back to the
house. Yeah. So when I come home, I make a big salad, or sometimes it's late. If I leave at 6, I try to eat before 7 all the time.
Right.
Sometimes it doesn't happen, but if it's late, I will stop by at a restaurant that it has like a pita, like falafel and pita bread and salads. So I just get, just give me the salads, just sure. cucumber, tomato, shredded carrots. And so it's very good, very satisfying.
And how many calories do you figure you get in a day eating that way in that little small time frame window?
I think 2,200, 2,500, because I'm very active.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't undereat. I don't overeat.
You eat till you're full.
Yes, I'm learning. You know, it's just a journey. I'm not an expert or perfect, and I realize that. I feel at my best when I don't stuff myself.
Right.
In the past, I used to do that, and there's like a very common advice in the raw vegan movement, like, yeah, you just have to fool yourself because you're gonna be hungry. No, I think as long as you keep doing the raw thing, your body becomes cleaner. And right. I kind of agree with John Bennett. I don't know if you're familiar with him, or Lauren Lockman. They say that they don't need much. They don't need much to have this vitality. Lou Corona says the same thing. So I totally believe that the cleaner you become, the less you need. But that's, you know, I don't want to encourage anyone to become anorexic or to undereat.
Sure.
When you're in this transitional phase to be raw vegan, you need to eat, because people don't understand the amount of food that you need to fulfill your caloric needs.
That's true. That is true. And a lot of raw foods are very hydrating. They have a lot of water in them. So, you know, that tends to move through you pretty quickly. And yeah, so you don't, and I don't necessarily mean, you know, in bowel movements, but definitely in urinating, it's, you will find you have to go to the bathroom quite a bit. It can be a little irritating, especially in the middle of the night when you're eating a bunch of watermelons during the day and you're like, oh my gosh, oh my Lord. Oh my gosh. But it's wonderful. And you know, it's so funny. It's so funny. Somebody asked me, well, you know, doesn't a watermelon tear your stomach up? And my mother used to say this too. She used to say, you know, if you're bound up and you need to go to the bathroom, eat a watermelon and you'll go to the bathroom. So for years I thought, oh, I don't want to eat a lot of watermelon because I don't want to get a stomach ache. And it's so funny. I can eat an entire watermelon. I mean, and I'm not talking a little one. I can eat a whole big watermelon, you know, within a half a day. And I've never had a stomach ache ever. I think Chris Kendall may have cleared that up for me when he said food combining, when you mix fat and melons, it's a bad food combining system there. You don't want to do that. And I think a lot of folks, I don't know if you're familiar with this in your culture, but up here in the States, we're notorious about eating watermelons at barbecues. And what's at barbecues? Chicken and pork chops and steaks, and you break out a big watermelon. Well, sure, you got a bunch of fat, a watermelon, and you get a stomach ache.
Yeah. Very bad food combining. That's why people are so afraid of fruits, because they don't think that is the other thing that makes them sick. Right. It's the fruit. No. It's the fruit just lets you know what you were doing wrong.
That's probably true. How do you stay raw? How do you keep from being tempted to cooked food?
When I was high raw, I experimented with being raw for certain weeks and then going back to cooked food. So for me, it was more like trial and error during that transitional phase. So I know how I feel when I go back to cooked food, and my body, the cleaner it becomes, it overreacts if I introduce again cooked food. So it could be, you know, acne next day. It's just so fast. It's the signals of my body, like, okay, yeah, you ate this. Here's your award. Next day you have something, right? So it will be either acne, or it would be, I don't know, different things. Feeling not vibrant enough, sluggish. So I learned my lessons. So that's what keeps me going. And it's, you know, people are not aware of how good you can feel by actually eating the right way. So for me, it's just, you know, I just want to feel at my best every time. Like it's almost 10 p.m. maybe here. I'm not sleepy. I haven't had a drop of coffee in a week. I quit coffee a long time ago, but sometimes I have it because I know it's a drug and it works really well when I need it. But I haven't had coffee the whole week, and I've been eating really very clean this week, and I feel proud of myself, because even though I've been stressed out and all that, I didn't need anything to cop up. Sometimes I haven't stopped being raw, but sometimes I eat like a date and cashew bar, which is not considered raw, the cashews. So, and when that happens, it's because I'm stressed. For some reason, I go back to comfort raw food, if you want to call it that way.
Right.
When I do that, I don't feel at my best next day. So I know. And it's just amazing to, I mean, feel this energetic and have mental clarity and not being, you know, like ready for sleep. And I don't know, it's just amazing, the vitality that you get. Yeah.
And those folks, they, people that pay you, they need you on top of your game. And if on top of your game is a raw vegan diet, then you definitely need to stay on it. And that may be what sets you apart, you know, from the others.
Definitely. Yeah. It's an advantage. Actually, I think it's an advantage. And it's not only the performance and the productivity and being able to, you know, keep up even when I don't have any stimulants on me, because all the food is a stimulant. Sure. It's also the way you see life. You know, you are more content, you're more satisfied, you're more connected. I don't know. It just puts you in another realm, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you, you know, most folks say that they have five go-to foods that when you get home, you say, oh, you know what? I don't have the energy to make a salad. I mean, as easy as a salad is to make, I love salads. Don't get me wrong. I love them. They're one of my favorite foods. But let's just say you just don't have the energy to make a salad and you have a go-to. What is your go-to of go-tos? What's the one you say, I'm going here. This is what I need. What is that?
It could be bananas and romaine lettuce.
I love that. Oh, I love it. Bananas. Oh, they're the best. They're the best. And so do you eat your bananas and the romaine lettuce together? Or are you talking about separately?
Yes, like a taco.
I have never tried that.
Yeah, you just peel the banana, put it in between the, and then put not only one leaf, but more. And then make like a roll, not a taco, but like a burrito.
Yeah. have you tried it with kale or maybe turnip green or mustard green? You know, they have a more of a, I guess, a durable leaf, something with a little more bite to it. Have you tried that?
You know, I've been moving from like all these elaborate recipes in the Ravian world towards a more simple thing. So right now I don't tolerate kale. I don't tolerate like very starchy, hard leafy greens. So I think it's just romaine or arugula or spinach or mixed greens, what I go for.
Right. I make all sometimes my...
No,
you go ahead. Go ahead.
Sometimes I have raw nori rolls.
Oh, yeah.
So I put, if I want something like, I mean, it's, for many people, probably it's not great, but sometimes I like the mixture of flavors of the banana with the nori roll.
That's an interesting combination.
I know. It's weird. It's weird.
Have you, we were introduced to something that I was absolutely in love with the other day. It was a jicama roll, and it was a jicama that was cut really thin, almost like the size of a small corn tortilla. And they had shredded cucumbers and shredded carrots rolled up, almost like a taquito, and I dipped it in some guacamole, and holy smokes, was it divine.
I can imagine.
Oh my gosh, it's so good. So good. That's kind of a new thing. And in my, you mentioned some of the not so bitter greens. I usually drink a green smoothie every morning, and it's Dr. Brooke Goldner. I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Brooke Goldner.
Yeah, she's great.
I'm interviewing her next week, by the way, so I'm super excited about that. Oh my gosh, she's one of my heroes. And but her power green smoothies every morning. That's 3/4 of a pitcher of spinach, 25% of fruit and some flax seeds and some water, and blend away, and it's the best. Oh,
I would love to do that. I would love to do that, but it's not practical for me. Like, I would rather run, and my smoothie, I will make it in my own stomach. So, when I have my first meal, it's going to be fruit and greens all the time. It's not, it makes that blended. Yeah.
However you get it in there, however you
exactly.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, you know, Dr. Early, I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge fan of you. And I'm so thankful that you said yes. Just to be able to speak to you, to pick your brain. You know, there's a vast amount of knowledge up there. And I'm so excited that I got to speak with you. I'm so thankful.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for saying that, Trey. Yeah, that's amazing. And I'm so excited to be here. You made me reflect on all the things that, you know, probably are going to serve me to keep going.
Good, good. I hope that's what we accomplished here. And then not only with you, but also someone with your credentials will give weight to what we're speaking about, you know, and that goes a long ways. And it's not that folks who are inspirational folks or influential folks out there, not that they don't have a voice. It's just, it's nice to have some affirmation with someone who has the knowledge that you have. And I find that fascinating, and I appreciate it so much.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. And I'm happy that it's helping. Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, how can folks find you? You know, where do they need to go to find Dr. Aureli?
Yeah, so I have the same handle for most social media platforms. So I'm Raw Vegan Doctor. So if you go to Instagram and just look for me at Raw Vegan Doctor, I'm there. Facebook, same thing, you know, Facebook/Raw Vegan Doctor. Twitter, just put Raw Vegan Doctor and I'm like that. And YouTube, I'm trying to be more consistent with my channel, uploading weekly videos. So it's YouTube, just Google, put in the browser Raw Vegan Doctor and I'm there. So I'm trying to build my website. So it's going to have the same name, rawvegandoctor.com. Still not yet up there, but it's coming.
Good deal. Good deal. I will put all of the links in the notes as well below. So
great.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you so much. And, I appreciate you coming on board and, maybe we'll get to meet up someday, maybe one of these fruit festivals or something, and we can talk shop. It'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah. I look forward to it.
All right. Sure. Well, you be safe and, take care. We'll talk to you later.
Take care, you too, and keep doing what you're doing. It's amazing.
Thank you so much, dude. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, how about that? Dr. Aureli is just a pleasure, just an absolute pleasure to talk to. You know, she just exudes spirit. She exudes caring, and you can just hear it in her voice. She just wants to help people. That's all she wants to do. And she absolutely 100% believes that the raw plant-based lifestyle is the way to go. Wow, just wow. I really, really, really hope you enjoyed it. I just absolutely love talking with her, and hopefully we'll get to follow her and see where this life takes her. I think the future is very bright for this young lady, and I can't wait to see it. So, with that being said, I hope everyone has a great day, an even better week, and remember that good choices equal good consequences. If you're going to be a statistic, please be a good one. Love y'all. Peace out.